Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. A 2018 AARP survey finds 1 in 3 U.S. adults older than 45 are lonely. Studies show that isolation and loneliness are as bad for health as obesity or smoking. Today we discuss loneliness and later in the hour how the internet has changed dating. With us this morning is therapist Ann Gagan, psychiatrist Jonathan Swartz, and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. Good morning to you all.
Good morning, Mindy.
All right, so being alone and being lonely are two different things, but both are on the rise.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, yes, they are two different things. Being alone is really just describes a state of where you are. You might be living alone, or you might be alone most of the day. And sometimes that doesn't bother people.
Yeah, some people like it.
Yeah, they like it and actually seek it out too. But being lonely means you're longing for contact. It's a yearning kind of a state that is unsettling because it's not satisfied. That state, that emotional state, is what has the negative consequences health-wise. And we can list the different health consequences. They are two different things, although, you know, they do get confused.
Yeah. I mean, so in 1950, less than 10% of American households contained only one person. By 2010, it was 27%. And on the Cape, we have a lot of people who feel very, very lonely. I know that's one of the issues you deal lot with.
Yes, I do. I'm lonely because their status in life has changed, perhaps because they were married and their spouse died, or they are a divorcee, or they have come here to live and take care of their elderly parents, and then the parents die and they're left on the Cape, having left a profession and social network from where they used to live. So many, many people find themselves sitting on the Cape, not knowing how to connect, and feeling it's an ache. It's an ache to want to connect with people and have meaningful relationships where they're known and loved and cared for. It's just not random. You know, you can go someplace and have random relationships, but that's not what the lonely seek. The lonely seek to be understood and loved and known.
Mm. Yeah. Do you see this a lot in your practice, Jonathan?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. You know, I was just thinking about how this is also one of the unintended consequences of the shift in our culture, in which, you know, 50 years ago, 100 years ago, you'd have multiple generations living together. The opportunity to be even alone, never mind lonely, you know, was certainly much less than what it is now, where there's so much transient, so much movement, and people tend to be further away from the network in which they grew up. So somebody who comes to the Cape, for example, or to the New Bedford area where I am, to look after a parent, and then is now then left alone. But 50 years ago, that would have been much less likely to happen for all kinds of reasons.
And last month, we talked about caregivers, and that sort of kind of got us into the thought of loneliness, because caregivers are a group of people who are so, you know, entrenched in caring for whoever they're caring for that they often are suffering from loneliness.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the person they're caring for might not be able to relate to them like they used to.
That's an example of being lonely without being alone.
Right.
And, you know, the years that I've grown up, I was just thinking during the 50s and 60s, the common goal that people had was to be independent, to be out on your own. It was always important to get your own apartment, I remember, as a status symbol almost. You know, that was a change, I think, in generations before. And, you know, I think we pay something for that, certainly. But I think it was a factor in our culture.
It's also, to think about it, how people feel when they're lonely. They're very ashamed of it.
Yes.
Because there's the psychological idea that I shouldn't be like this.
That's
I shouldn't
right.
admit that I'm lonely. I'm a loser. Life shouldn't be like this. I talk to many people who see what they thought their life was going to be like, and then either circumstances or their personal choices have led them to a life that does not have the social, you know, contacts that they feel are they should deserve or they've earned. Mm-hmm. And it's very painful because you see the world in that way too.
Right.
That you walk into a room and I'm a stranger. and I am not welcome.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right. And to be lonely is perhaps you're invited to interpret that as, I guess I don't have many friends, because mm-hmm. if I had a rich, you know, set of friends, I wouldn't be lonely. So to say that I'm lonely is almost to say, like, people don't like me.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Which means that you don't have value or not importance. And I think we're a species that we exist out of the relationships that we have. We know we exist because of the relationships. We see ourselves as real because of what gets reflected back to us. And if we don't have that reflection, taps into some very desperate states of being alive, because you don't have that connection. That's why solitary confinement is such a harmful tool that torturers use.
I was thinking too. You know, we have a lot of people here who maybe have lost a spouse, and if you happen to have a relationship where, you know, you're married to your best friend, you do everything together, and you know that's kind of your whole world. When one dies, then you're left with, what do I do now? And how do you, you know, if I haven't made new friends in a long time, and, you know, the circles that you maybe hang out with, you know, the your interests might change, and it, you know, kind of change your circle. You can see how somebody could all of a sudden wake up one day and go, how did I get here?
It's so painful, especially in the early years after the death of a spouse. You have had that person that is your mirror, whether it's a good or bad or indifferent mirror. You've had the routines, you've had the habits, you've had the, I always say, the inside joke. What couples have, which I think is marvelous, is the shorthand. They just can see something from the same eyes and have that inside joke. And when you lose that partner, that person you've spent your life forming all these habits and rituals and customs and enjoyments with, nothing measures up.
No,
family doesn't measure up.
Right.
They try, but they don't measure up because what you have with a spouse is so very intimate. So the world can look quite bleak following the death of a spouse, and it's very, very hard work from what I've seen, but noble work to try and create a social network that is satisfying enough.
So talk a little bit about the health impacts. What are we talking about? What kinds of things?
Oh, all sorts of diseases. Cancer, heart disease.
Diabetes.
Diabetes, exactly. Yeah, weight gain. Sleep impairment, sleep troubles. All sorts of things that basically harm us over chronically, you know, over a long term. They're not necessarily acute illnesses. Because it's a state of stress. And when we're in a state of stress, we have a biological orchestra that plays. And that orchestra is very dysphonic. It is very annoying to our homeostasis, our evenness in our body. Destroys living tissue, inflammation, et cetera. Immunity, if I didn't mention that, is a very big target of loneliness, or at least a result of loneliness, impaired immunity. So that opens you to all sorts of conditions.
Finding the key to why you're lonely is, I would imagine, the key to fixing it, right? Figuring out why, because you could, like we were saying, you could be living alone, you've lost a spouse, but you could be living with a whole family and be lonely. I mean, you can be surrounded by people and feel lonely,
and what I think one of the big stumbling blocks or block to doing something about it, and you can speak with this more directly perhaps, is that you start developing, if you don't already have the notion, that you're not worthy. If you really were an important individual, you wouldn't be lonely. People would be reaching out to you and enjoying your presence. But because they're not, then you're defective. So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
A vicious cycle, because the idea that I'm not worthy, you walk into a room and you see yourself as inadequate.
Right.
And you talk to yourself and you have this critical mind, a critical voice saying, is this going to be another losing situation? Nobody reaches out to me. Then you pick up the social cues because you walk into a room with that attitude and people may just ignore you, and you mm-hmm. see that as a complete rejection. So it can look like depression, I'd like to hear.
It's not an inviting look, at least.
Yeah,
I think people do pick up on that.
Yeah, it's how you're perceiving the world. Like, I think with some of this literature we were looking at, somebody goes to work and, you know, Bob is ignoring them and they say, oh, it's me. You know, Bob is mad at me or not mm-hmm. talking to me. And the other employee on the other side goes, oh, Bob's having a bad day. And it turns out Bob's having a bad day. But mm-hmm. because you're feeling this sense of, like, worthlessness, you're going to think, yeah, Bob, it's me. It's not Bob, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So what about the thought of ants and depression? Is depression part of this?
Can be.
It can be.
Certainly can be. One of the risks is moving on to a clinical type depression with other signs and symptoms. But it is not necessarily, that's not necessarily the only route to depression. Depression represents loss, really. And there is a loss in being lonely. You're losing the social comforts, the social contacts that are so necessary to survival.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. You don't usually think of loneliness per se in the context of what happens when people retire. Mm-hmm. But I see so many people for whom their work is their identity.
Yeah.
Sure, they mm-hmm. have a spouse at home, they have children or grandchildren, but for 40 years or whatever it's been, you know, there's that intimacy at work, the shorthand mm-hmm. Of having those inside jokes at work. And for a lot of people, they've spent more time with their coworkers than they do with the people they're married to, or at least awake anyway.
Yeah.
And so often you see people who retire, and they've looked forward to retirement for, you know, so many years. They've counted the months, the days, the weeks. It's ridiculous. And then they retire, and they got nothing going on.
Right.
And although it's certainly in some ways profoundly different than, let's say, being a caretaker for a spouse who then mm-hmm. passes away, but there are some similarities, too, that are really important.
Well, and it goes back to what you were talking about culture earlier. I mean, when you're at a cocktail party or somewhere, and so they're, they don't say, what do you like to do? What's your hobbies? It's what do you do, right? What do you
do
for a living? And so, yeah, so it really is very much tied to your identity. Mm-hmm. All right. So social connections. I mean, we are social creatures, right? So this is, but, you know, I'm thinking there's some people who like to be alone. You say, like the hermit guy that's, you know, living off by himself and really doesn't have much contact with people. There are people who really, mm-hmm. you know, Greta Garbo, I just want to be alone, you know,
who
don't need as much social. Mm-hmm. But most of us need social interactions, right?
Right, yeah, definitely. It's survival, and it's baked into our psyche, baked into our DNA from survival. The reason that our species has been so successful on this planet is that we've been social, and we've been able to cooperate and relate to one another, and combine our efforts, divide up tasks into specialty. Tasks, for instance, we build houses, but very rarely does one person build a house now. It's all done out by dividing up the specialties. And you don't see other animals doing that. It's responsible for our success, as good or as bad as that is. It's just necessary.
Yeah.
Like air.
You know, the other group, I think that they've studied the group that scored highest in loneliness are the Generation Z, 18 to 22, and the millennials, 23 to 37. They scored highest.
Highest of being lonely.
And yeah. I think this is really important because, again, on the Cape, we hear from young people they have to leave the Cape because there's nothing to do here.
Right. It's boring. They're bored. Boring, yeah.
And they've maybe not as many opportunities for social connection. And I think that this what the studies say is that aside from many of them don't have regular workplaces they go to, they might be working out of their apartment or they mm-hmm. go to a workspace. They don't have that regular thing you just mm-hmm. mentioned, Jonathan, mm-hmm. about the group of people that you work with and you become friends with. And also, and we're going to get to this later, the social media, where you scan through Facebook and you see everybody doing these amazing mm-hmm. things, and you feel left out, that whole FOMO, you know, fear of missing out phenomenon, which is really real. I hear you know, kids talking about that all the time. They feel like, I need to be here, but I'm not included, and why am I not included? And as we all know, we only seem to post the highlights of our life, not the everyday activities. So that group, for many reasons, suffers a great deal from loneliness. And you'll see that in their music and literature and in movies.
Right. The notion that I post, therefore I am, because you're advertising. Maybe that's not the right word to use, but you know, you're letting people know about what you've done, what you had for breakfast, or where you had dinner last night, and somehow that's expected to. I mean, it clearly has value for a lot of people. I myself often puzzle at the amount of time people spend letting others know where they had dinner last night, but it does fend off.
It's a need, perhaps.
Yeah, sure.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about loneliness, and coming up, we're going to discuss how the internet has changed dating. With us this morning is therapist Ann Gagan, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So we're talking a little bit about social media and Facebook. And, you know, it's interesting because, you know, Facebook comes along where these social creatures are thinking, aha, this is going to solve all their problems. Right? We're going to have all these friends and, you know, be able to make relationships around the world. And I guess for some people, I mean, I think it's a great tool for grandparents and things who are far away, and you can, you know, FaceTime and, you know, do your Facebook stuff with your grandkids and see them a little more often than you would, you know, just making your, you know, annual trip or whatever. But there's a downside to it too. And I think, Anne, you touched on it when we were talking about the loneliness that some younger people feel, and that is they are not living these fabulous lives that they're seeing play out on Facebook, which is not reality. But we have this, especially young people seem to, and reality has, I don't know, different, I don't know what reality, you know, they think is happening there. But I mean, so the internet in itself, there's good and bad there. I mean, so when we're talking about loneliness, Facebook might not be the place you want to go if you're feeling lonely. But Jonathan, before we went on the air, you mentioned some things like maybe you're interested in birds and you might want to go online and find a bird club. Or, I mean, there are things you can do with the internet to help with your loneliness.
Such a powerful use of the internet is particularly for people who have, you know, interests that aren't, I mean, you know, if you're a Patriots fan, you don't really need the internet to strike up a conversation. But if you're, let's say, living in a small village and you're transgender, wow, you know, in fact, I think of this because that was, I heard an interview a couple of years ago on one of the NPR programs where, you know, this was an example of how the internet allowed someone like that to touch a world of people that otherwise they would never be able to find. So whether it's, you know, coin collecting or whatever it might be, the internet is powerful like nothing else can be.
You know, a great point that, and I've in sitting with patients, I know I've often, when they complain about loneliness, I ask them about, you know, what have you done just with a computer? Because you can, the person can communicate without the social anxiety of face-to-face interactions. It's a good way to practice when you're set against or when you're frightened of certain social interactions, which is a common.
Interesting, and you mentioned that this group of lonely people, 18 to 24, who is a generation that certainly is using the internet constantly, and actually in some cases may their loneliness may be magnified by their use. Then there's the much older population of lonely people, such as people whose spouses have passed away or whatever. And in many cases, those are people who've actually been somewhat allergic to using the internet, never mind for dating, but just for anything. Afraid of afraid of technology, anxious about, you know, whether they're not going to be able to acquire a new skill in using that. So you have two very different populations, one who avoids the internet one who overuses the internet, both feeling lonely, probably in a way that feels different, but still would be described as lonely.
Yeah, and I think for those, a lot of the senior centers offer classes that help seniors learn how to use the internet. I mean, you know, if that was something you wanted to figure out how to do, because once you start doing it, it becomes second nature. But yeah, and believe me, when they're like phones, the kids can do these things on the phones. It's like, if you can't figure out your phone, ask somebody who's 18, who's younger than 18, and they can tell you. And that sort of brings up another issue. You know, these kids are, I mean, they sleep with their phones are with them 24/7 because they don't want to miss out on anything, which of course is not very healthy. You know, you're waking up in the middle of the night, you're not getting the sleep you should be getting. I know a lot of parents struggle with when to give their kids, you know, access to this kind of thing and how much and all of that, because the world, it's changing so fast and we didn't grow up with this technology. So it's a lot to keep up with when you have to, you know, monitor that for the younger people in your family.
It seems to me like the smartphone is a way of people denying their loneliness. Because they're never really alone and they can always direct their attention to it and connect. And you feel important when you're connected. We've all seen in the shopping malls, four or five teenagers sitting around and they're all on their phone.
Yeah, they're not talking, yeah.
Texting someone else or whatever.
And that's interesting too, because, you know, when I'm just thinking back to Facebook, when you're seeing conversations and seeing things that maybe some of your relatives, a cousin or somebody, your brother has posted, you went, I didn't know they thought like, and it's like, it would be a great conversation starter if you're having a real conversation, but it's not a conversation you can have texting or on Facebook.
Right. No, it's...
Yeah. It's something's missing in terms of social skills.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I think has happened in our culture is that as parents, we've tried to buffer our children from any kind of discomfort. I'm making a general statement now, but... and so when meeting with someone face-to-face or being with a group of people... The social skills are, you know, the kids might feel awkward. Mm-hmm. When you're first dating, you might feel awkward. Well, awkward isn't a bad feeling, really, you know, and I think we've tried to move away from any moment of discomfort, and yet we learn from those moments if we reflect. Just going back to loneliness in general, one has to acknowledge you're lonely before you can change it. And I think that there are so many little steps that you can take to move away from that idea of I'm a loser, I'm because I'm lonely. I'm
shame.
Lonely.
Yeah,
the shame part.
Yeah.
I'm lonely because I don't have the relationships that I want to have in my life. Now what? And changing the thinking around that. First, you have to acknowledge. Then you can change the thinking, and then what effects it had. Mark, you talked about the effects that this is making me feel crummy. This is making me feel self-conscious, and so this is making me feel crummy. What can I do about it?
Eat potato chips to feel better.
Exactly. That's an immediate
immediate high
response. And eat potato chips with somebody. Offer somebody a potato chip and eat it with them. But you almost have to come to the point where you say, I've got to do something about this.
Right.
And it can be done.
Sure.
Yeah.
It can be done.
It has to be said, I guess, that, you know, being lonely is not a character flaw.
Right.
It's a feeling.
That's right.
It's a feeling.
You know, it probably took me 2 years to realize that when my younger patients would say to me, yeah, I'm talking to so-and-so, I'm talking to so-and-so. It took me 2 years to realize they weren't talking to anybody. They're texting.
Yes.
You know, what they were saying was, I'm starting to, like, think about dating this person. You know, I met this person online and we're talking. But they weren't actually yet talking. They actually had never met it, and that's an everyday constant experience.
Yeah. Sure.
But it took me a long time to really like that's talking.
So since you brought that up, let's switch gears a little bit and talk about how the internet has changed the way we date. And I have to say, I only recently kind of got some information on this because I haven't been in the dating pool for quite a while. But I was talking to a couple of younger people and they were talking about the online, dating apps. There's a lot of different apps. And that seems to be the way, way younger people meet each other. Like you're saying, your younger patients, they're texting. I think I saw something that Lindsay Lohan's mom is getting married to somebody that she's never met, right? Was like they have this, like, I don't know, text, whatever conversation. But I was like, how do you marry somebody that you have never met? But it's like, it's a whole new world, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. People do that. Yeah. I have patients that got married with women from, two women from the Philippines that they never met.
Yeah. And that, of course, that's happened. I mean, that's nothing new. That,
right. But actually, went ahead and had a wedding without having met the person?
That I haven't seen, but I imagine it's possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. All right. So, Mark, do you want to share your story with online
Yeah,
dating?
Sure.
You shared it before. That's why I'm not really putting it on the spot.
I did before. I was in a long-term marriage that was really got bankrupt toward the end of the years. I felt lonely when we split up. So I decided that I would investigate this online thing, because then it was just, this was 2003. So then it was just kind of being the thing.
Yeah. New.
New. Yeah. Exactly. In thinking about how to go about it, I knew that Jewish people, I'm part Jewish myself, Jewish people have a compulsion about matchmaking. It goes back centuries. And it's a very important thing, the yenta who makes the matches. An app called JDate, which was primarily attracted Jewish people. So I applied to it. The way it worked, you know, you see pictures and you do a little bit of emailing. I really only responded to one person. Her picture reminded me, and this gets into the nature of love, reminded me of my high school girlfriend. Her hairstyle was similar. I wrote to her.
What else do you need?
Really? Yeah, really? I like her. Yeah.
You know, I told her I was an old guy, maybe was trying to rekindle my youth and relive high school romance. Maybe we could get together. Well, we did get together. It was the only person I really connected with online, you know, it did any kind of email or calling. And we got married. Yeah. We've been married very happily now for 16 years or so. Yeah. So it was my first date in 34 years. And, it worked.
Yeah.
There is... Oh, we can get into the nature of how love develops, how attraction develops, and this is an example of that certainly. There was a gut feeling, and I acted on it, and happy I did.
Yeah, I said it's big business, right? It's a $1.8 billion year online dating industry, $1.8 billion annually. But you know, the other thing that's interesting, and I. There are different, a whole bunch of 7,500 different websites worldwide, or apps, I should say, that people can use. And from what I understand, there are different apps for different generations, so to speak. Like when I was talking to a couple of people at one of our pub nights, and they said, yeah, the older people are on Match.com and younger people are on Tinder or some of the, I don't know what all the different apps are. But one of the guys I was talking to was interesting. He said, yeah, I was like, but, you know, this was on one of the islands. You live on an island. He said, yeah, but, you know, I ask a woman out and she looks at me like a deer in headlights and, you know, doesn't know what to say. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wow, it's a whole different world, isn't it? I mean, that these younger people growing up with, as you're saying, the texting and, you know, the electronics, like, this is how you meet people online.
Yeah. The contrasts are interesting. I just at one of my support groups last week, I asked the folks that were there, tell me your love story. How did you meet? And the stories ranged from meeting at a ski lodge to of a friend of a friend, all the natural systems whereby people used to meet through churches and so on. Now my sister is a wedding officiant, and she'll ask, well, how did you meet? And online, two words, online. Mm-hmm. And versus these wonderful elaborate stories that I heard and when I asked about their meeting and love stories. So I suppose that, you know, one could see something's missing, but if the efficiency of the online sites, if you eliminate what you don't want and go towards what you want, it's probably very efficient.
Oh, yes. Yeah, sure. No.
I met my wife at a gym, and it seems so corny to tell people that. It makes me feel very old-fashioned. I'm going to start telling people I met her online.
Exactly.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, actually, online is now the second most common way that couples hook up, you know, for long-lasting relationships. The most common is what you folks just mentioned, through friends.
Yeah,
chance encounters, et cetera.
And the other thing is, I was trying to find it, but the number of people who lie.
More than half.
More than half lie on their dating profile.
Right.
And I was thinking, are people going to figure that out? You can't keep
Isn't
up with
it remarkable?
That? Yeah,
it's
like,
remarkable. People posting pictures of themselves 20
like
20
years
ago,
and then they show up and go, "Who are you? You're my date's dad. Who are you?" Right.
Well, people, you have to advertise yourself to get some interest or some hook.
And talk about feeling bad there too. Now you go up on one of these sites and then nobody contacts you.
Yeah.
What does that say, right?
Sure.
I guess that one of the things they say in there, if you're going to do that, you have to fill in all the information. If you're only putting in a couple of things, they're not going to respond. So you have to, I guess, put in all the info, right?
Yeah, and people will be attracted or connected with all sorts of things and not just a picture.
Mm-hmm.
But interest is a big thing, and not just walking on the beach. At sunset. Real interests that you have and real things that are important in your life. I did learn recently that there's a dating site for Trump supporters that you can meet your so-called soulmate, as Anne said, soulless person, Trump.com or TrumpDating.com, whatever it is.
And there's a Christian website, there's a Jewish.
I still miss, there was a radio show on for many years. I used to listen to it all the time, even though I was married, and I certainly wasn't looking to date anybody, but I just found it so intriguing. Dick Syatt's Singles Hotline.
Oh, my
Does anybody
goodness.
Remember
no,
that show?
No.
It was on one of the Boston stations, and he... people would call in, talk about walking on the beach, people would call in and he would ask them to describe themselves and what they do and how old are they and what kind of person they're looking for, what kind of qualities. And of course, everybody would say, I want somebody with a great sense of humor and I love walking, taking walks on the beach. and then he would have these gatherings for singles at places like in Randolph at the Lantana, function halls.
Where people would show up,
That's right. And singles would come and there'd be a dance. As I describe it now, it just sounds so 18th century. But it wasn't that long ago.
So you remember speed dating, right?
That was
a thing too, right?
Right.
All right. We have an email from Kristen who says, I keep hearing people say that we only post our best selves, especially as a mom, and not what is reality. But I don't want to pull my phone out and take pictures of my kids when they're not feeling well or when they're throwing a temper tantrum. Just like a family photo album, I use Instagram to share the sweet moments of our life. I'm not trying to make people think my life is perfect, but I don't feel the need to share the sad and messy parts of life. We wouldn't pull a camera out in the 90s to take a photo of a screaming child, so why do it now?
Mm-hmm.
I actually have done that. when temper tantrum and my husband's at work and I'm like, look, this is what I'm dealing with.
Well, that I think that's an appropriate use of Instagram and Facebook. It's just I think what we're pointing out is that for a person that is sitting by themselves in a base room apartment and is 45 years old and hasn't had a date, to go through these sites and just look at all this beautiful stuff happening can really make them feel especially alienated. But it doesn't mean there's anything wrong with posting.
It depends on how they look at it. You can also look at it as what an opportunity here.
Mm-hmm.
You're never going to catch a fish until you have a line in the water, and the more lines you have, the more chance you have of getting the right kind of fish.
Mm-hmm.
So, people look at things, pessimistically or at least optimistically to some extent.
Peggy is giving us a call from Mashpee. Good morning, Peggy.
Good morning, Mindy. Nice to talk to you.
You too.
And I'm enjoying your program so much. So as you know, this last weekend we had a rather long article about this topic in the Cape Cod Times. And I did want to add that although I think, loneliness is definitely out there, it's so balanced by having met hundreds of singles over the last years with with hopefulness. And these are older singles, married, divorced, never married, divorced, and widowed, men and women. And I think the fear of what this new world of dating is like, whether it's online or offline, is an education in and of itself. Mm-hmm. And it's remarkable to see people who are 60, 70, 80 years old, willing, eager to learn and to try new things and to be proactive and to, you know, like if you buy a condominium and you've looked at 100 till you get the one you want, you know, they're willing to try and try again. Mm-hmm. And it's remarkable what the other side, the flip side of the loneliness, if they can just get themselves.
Yeah. Peggy started. Brings up a really good point about the fear, right? I mean, think about that. It would be very scary if you've, you know, been married as long as some of us are married and it never being too late. And what comes to mind, Cynthia Riggs, the author on Martha's Vineyard, who she had no intention of getting married again. She got married, I think he was 93. She was in her late 80s. And, you know, Howard recently died, but they had a few good years together. They knew each other when they were much younger. And so had this, you know, long time in between. But and their romance story, that was a national story, you know, crazy. And we just recently talked to Madeleine Kuhnen, who was governor of Vermont. She was also the ambassador to Switzerland. And she got married again in her 70s. And that was the love of her life. So good point, Peggy. It's never
Diane
too late.
Reem.
Yeah, Diane Reem, of course. Diane. That's right. Diane Reem, who recently
came. Diane Reem at 81. And our article in the New York Times 10 years ago, she was 74 years old.
Yeah.
You know, it's never too late.
Never too late. Peggy,
never too late.
Thanks for calling
and
reminding
Dr.
us.
As Dr. Helen Fisher says, it's from age 2 to 92, we're ready for love.
There you go.
Peggy, thanks for calling. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point, and we are talking about loneliness and how the internet has changed dating. With us is therapist Ann Gagan, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So we're talking about loneliness, a feeling.
A feeling, yes. I recently read a book that explained where feelings come from, what they are, really. We take them as a natural part of being alive. But they really have a history actually going back 3.8 billion years ago, if you can believe that, the first form of life on this planet were bacteria. Single-celled organisms without a nucleus, and they responded based on chemical reactions to the environment. They took some information in and they reacted in order to preserve their life. Actually, what they're reacting to is they're trying to maintain what's called homeostasis, and that is a range of temperature factors, nutrition, etc., that is acceptable to their life. Too much is fatal. Too little is fatal. Homeostasis, it's a factor, it's a basic driving factor of all life forms to keep things in kind of a window that is suitable to your physical being. Well, that drive for homeostasis is really what drove Darwinism, which drove survival of the fittest. Because survival of the fittest is those individuals or forms of life that have the ability to maintain homeostasis. So it's really homeostasis that drives it. Now you go up in evolution, fast forward several billion years to the pre-humans, but at least the ones that had a cortex. And they also obviously survive by maintaining homeostasis. The way we do it with the central nervous system is we have feelings. Feelings are just signals that there's something wrong homeostatically. Hmm. Something is not right, it doesn't suit our ideal range of living. And that's all it is. It's a signal. It's clearly in survival's interest to keep things homeostatically even. So if you look at feelings as not something, a state of being or a definition of you as a person, but it's really just your body, your brain telling you that something is amiss. And if you can look at loneliness as a signal that something is not right in your life, because socially, social comfort or connection is a very important ingredient in human homeostasis, which has been driving life for 3.8 billion years. Very basic to life, but it's just a signal.
So what about,
the other side of that is the positive feelings that we, you know, read about in these articles that lead to mating. So those are the positive feelings. So they're the negative feelings that perhaps might help preserve life in the sense of avoiding tragedy.
Sure.
But the positive feelings that would lead you to be attracted to somebody and to want to have a sexual relationship with
them. Yeah, that's
so love is
critical.
A feeling, too.
Absolutely. It's a critical feeling.
So what's going on in our brains there? Is it chemicals?
Well, yes and no. It's very interesting. If you observe a couple that's just gotten together and they really like each other and they maybe mutually see some future in being together, they're a little bit crazy.
Crazy in love, right? Yeah, we've heard that.
Yeah, right.
Love sick.
Yeah,
love
sick. Love sick.
Exactly. It's a positive feeling. It's a wonderful, rewarding sensation. And biologically, there's a reason for it.
It sickens everybody around them.
It could be. Yes, exactly. Because of the jealousy, really. Because it's so pleasurable. It's a high. There's a orchestration of hormones biologically that produce this. Hormones of neurotransmitters and hormones of testosterone, estrogen, that all get stimulated, and they stimulate pleasure and reward, the same pleasure and reward centers that are stimulated by other things that we have that are important to some people, say like drugs, for instance, that can be addictive, or other pleasurable high experiences. So the initial part of a connection that's important, the attractive phase, is the honeymoon phase. And there's interesting correlates of that. People are less, their judgment is a little bit turned down. Critical judgment is a little bit turned down. And
blinded by love.
Blinded by love. Yeah. And it's a real thing.
It is a real thing,
And they are in a state of high. But of course, that doesn't last. Mm-hmm. But it's only there to stimulate attraction and connection and attachment, especially. That's the critical evolutionary goal by being in love is attachment, getting attached, because once you get attached, then you can reproduce and the species goes on. So the high inevitably leaves. And if you're...
Better have something in common.
Yes, exactly. You better have something in common, because that's what attachment is all about, is being able to share and connect on a very deep level, really know the other person as opposed to just be infatuated by them and dizzy in love with them. It probably has received more human attention than any other emotion over the eons. But it does work biologically. There is definitely a biological substrate leads you to believe, well, maybe you could make a pill and get yourself in love that way. I don't know if that's going to happen. But there is definitely a biological basis for it. And, of course, the psychology of it feeds right into it reinforce its repetition and its need that people experience to obtain.
It's interesting to note also that oxytocin, which is a hormone that's released during nursing of a newborn and which promotes the bonding between mom and newborn, also is released in higher quantities during a period of infatuation. And I just find that really
And especially attachment, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Attachment, too.
It's almost like creating a glue,
right? Yeah.
Through a hormonal glue.
Exactly. There's another interesting finding that interesting part of the biology is that there's a decrease of serotonin, which usually we associate with depression. But because the antidepressants, the common antidepressants, perform their duty by perform their work by increasing serotonin. But when you're in love, there's actually a decrease of it. Hmm. And that has a consequence, because then that opens the door for the obsessive experience of being in love. That's when you're always thinking about the person. And that is very much like an obsessive compulsive disorder, where people are too obsessed about certain details that they block out everything else. And the way we treat OCD or obsessive conditions is with a serotonin agent. We boost it up so that that can be lessened. So there's an interesting dance here of chemical hormones that result in these mental states.
What do you think drives the attraction? You know, like you're saying, you know, when you saw the picture of your wife, she had the same haircut or hairdo that you, so you had that kind of memory flashback of high school. Right. Is it a familiarity? Because I've had friends where I've got, gee, it's too bad I don't like them more than that. They're, you know, it's the perfect person, you know. Yeah. So what is it that drives that attraction? Is it early experience? Anybody have any thoughts on that?
I do, and I think it is early experience. Yeah. Early experience in which there was a favorable attachment before that you're trying to reestablish or re-experience.
Just to jump in, genetics for a long time has identified what's called associative mating, which we learned about in genetics back in college. And essentially that's the phenomenon whereby people tend to be attracted to and mate with people who are like themselves. Yep. Presumably a lot of it would have to do with not necessarily looking like me, but looking like somebody who was powerful figure early in my life, my mom, a grandparent, whatever. But I mean, you see that people tend to partner with people who maybe have the same blonde hair or the blue eyes or
the behavioral characteristics are very important too.
What's that?
The behavioral characteristics are critical.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the haircut apparently.
The way we learn to make decisions is by memory. What happens in the present stimulates memories, and we're responding to the present with the infusion of the information about the memories. Mm-hmm. And clearly, early memories, early experiences are critical, because that's when the brain is being formed.
Right. They like the way the other one smells. I mean, that's a really powerful.
He smells.
Totally. I've heard that over and over again. He smelled so fresh and clean.
Right.
That was it.
And there was research on that, pheromones. There's a little bit of an industry on it, too.
And also our sense of smell has a better memory than any of our other senses, which always surprises me to be reminded of, because I would have thought our vision, we would have a better memory. But smell, you think about smells that
you all of a sudden come across
in such a powerful way.
Yeah.
And it's the most primitive of our senses.
That's right.
It's also the one with the best memory.
Richard sent us, says, listening to your program on loneliness and dating, I met my wife at Meetup for Kayakers. Go to meetup.com to find people with similar interests. And that's great advice, right? Kayaking, I mean, there's all kinds of whatever your hobbies are. I know they say opposites attract, but that might be for that initial, honeymoon kind of thing.
Because
once that's over, what do you talk about? opposite interests.
But the opposites also, that phenomenon refers really more to certain character traits, like a messy person being drawn to a very neat, tidy, organized person, a person who's very planful being attracted to somebody who's very spontaneous. And generally speaking, that probably does work quite well, but that's probably not too involved in an initial attraction.
Right.
All right. Well, thank you, therapist Ann Gagan, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Oh, you're here the third Wednesday of the month. We'll talk to you next month. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.